Hi, hey, welcome to the Cordial Catholic Podcast, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. On this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Cheryl White, an expert on the Shroud of Turin, the ancient burial cloth of Jesus. This is a fantastic episode. We dig deep into this interesting and ancient relic, and we kind of unpack what it means for our faith, what it is, and all the interesting facts surrounding it. I think you'll love this episode, so please listen and enjoy. Dr. Cheryl White is a professor of history at Louisiana State University at Shreveport, a member of the American Confraternity of the Holy Shroud, and one of the co-hosts of the podcast, Who is the Man of the Shroud? And I am super excited to have her as our guest today. Hello, Dr. White.
Hello, how are you?
I am good. Thank you so much for joining us. We're in a
Great.
Couple
I'm
of...
thrilled to be here.
Yeah, we're in a couple of different time zones here. Normally you don't live in Alaska, but I'm catching you in a completely different time zone than you're used to. So thanks for making the time
That's
to
right.
join us.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks for having me.
So I have been really interested personally in the Shroud of Turin for a very long time, since even as an evangelical Christian, before I became Catholic, I had a real interest in the Shroud. It really fascinated me. So maybe we could pretend that our listeners have never, ever heard of the Shroud of Turin, our topic today. What do you think they need to know about it, starting at the very ground floor?
Oh, sure. So the shroud, the cloth we call the Shroud of Turin is a 14.5-foot strip of linen cloth, about 3.5 feet wide, that bears a very mysterious, inexplicable image of a man who was scourged and crucified in Roman fashion, who has a piercing in his right side, who is capped with a crown of thorns, and has over 362 separate scourge wounds on his body. So the real mystery about this cloth, well, there's a couple of them, but obviously the biggest mystery we have is how the image was formed, because the image is anatomically and forensically perfect. It cannot be replicated by any process known to us in the 21st century. So the big question we all have, the reason we're all pulled into the mystery of the shroud, is number one, there's only one person in history who bore these unique wounds. And of course, number two, if this is indeed an image of Jesus Christ, how did that image come to be on this particular cloth and be so perfect?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So it is purported to be the burial cloth of Jesus, and there's some biblical evidence we have that he would have been wrapped in a cloth like this. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. It is normal Jewish burial custom that that you be wrapped in a shroud. As a matter of fact, observant Jews today, know that this is still a burial custom, that their bodies are wrapped in a shroud. It's not uncommon today for people to pick out their own shrouds. Not only is it completely consistent with what we know about Jewish burial customs of the age, but we know from the particularly from the gospel narratives, and I'll cite specifically the Gospel of John, chapter 20. It's the resurrection narrative, the scene where Peter and John run to the tomb. And the very first thing, of course, Peter sees, or what John describes, is that they saw the burial cloth lying there. So we're talking about a shroud, and we're talking about another cloth, a separate cloth, that would have covered his head when they brought him down from the cross. So that's a separate cloth we could talk about later if you wanted to, but we do have biblical evidence that the body, and of course, even in the burial narrative, we're told that Joseph of Arimathea, a secret disciple for fear of the Jews, went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus, and then wrapped it in a clean linen shroud.
So there is, this is so fascinating to me, thank you. So there's even this very strong biblical evidence that some shroud existed, whether this is the shroud or not. There is biblical,
right.
There's biblical evidence that there was a shroud used. It was a common thing that they would have done. So your colleague, Father Peter Mangum, has called the shroud, I've heard him say this before, the most studied artifact ever, I think he said. Which is really interesting that this Catholic Christian artifact would be studied so intensely. Can you talk basically about some of the things that have been done to try and determine if this is an authentic burial cloth of Jesus?
Yeah. So we have a lot of challenges in trying to prove a supernatural event. And let me explain what I mean by that. Obviously, if this is a cloth that left behind a physical remain of a metaphysical event, or a natural process of a supernatural event, the problem we face immediately is that our technologies and our science, no matter how advanced they ever become, can never extend into the realm of the supernatural. We can never prove a supernatural event. However, nor can science refute it. So what we are left with is this. We're left with the fact that in 1978, the only comprehensive examination of the cloth ever to have taken place took place that year in Turin. There was a team of over 20 scientists who were given access to the cloth for 5 days, and they performed every known scientific test they could. And what they came up with is that it is not a painting. It is not a photograph. It is inexplicably perfect only on the very top fibers of the cloth. We know that there is human blood. It is type AB. Over 50 different species of pollen on the cloth that give it an environmental history that places it at some point in the old city of Jerusalem. There are soil samples on it that place it in the old city of Jerusalem, only found in that place on the earth. So this is what we can say with certainty. This is a cloth that bears the image of a man who was crucified and scourged in Roman fashion that has been in Jerusalem. And we will never be able to prove that it is the authentic burial cloth of Jesus Christ, but we are left to make those connections by faith for ourselves.
That's so fascinating. I was, wow. I was going to ask you, what are some of the truly amazing features of the shroud? I want to go there in a second, but I find it very fascinating the amount of detail that you can get from the shroud and the preciseness that you can, how precise you can be with the location, with all these different things. So we're saying that we know that this shroud was used in Jerusalem by a man who died in a fashion that's consistent with how Christ died. But obviously what you're saying is
right.
we can't know for sure it was Jesus, because you don't have a signed signature on a burial cloth or something saying this was Jesus's, or there's no I know your research as a historian deals largely with the history of the shroud.
Right.
I think trying to put together a chain of custody of some kind, right?
Right.
So say, in spite of all the scientific research that's being done to authenticate it, I know it is still criticized by people as being some kind of a fake from the Middle Ages or something, even if we can't replicate it. So what could you tell us about its origins, maybe? So we know,
sure.
I mean, for somebody who's the hardened skeptic who's going to say, well, we can't prove how it was done, but it must still be a fake, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know what I always want to say to people who question it, and I wouldn't even use the word skeptic, because I think skepticism is good. I think skepticism is a way that brings us to a sincere form of knowledge too, and ultimately brings many people to faith. And so I don't want to diminish that, but I will say that first of all, as I said, we're never going to be able to prove it doesn't prove the resurrection. Let me just say that. Even if we knew that this was the authentic burial cloth of Jesus Christ, it doesn't prove the resurrection. It proves that there is a process that created an image that we can't replicate. That's all we can really say.
Mm-hmm.
But as a historian, I will tell you that, it enters the undisputed record in the middle of the 14th century, 1355, when it goes on display in Lyrée, France. And it was in the possession of a family, the Deschernay family, who had an ancestor that had perhaps been in the Crusades, the Fourth Crusade. We don't know how that family came to possess it. And it is likely that it was taken from Constantinople during the sacking of that city in 1204. We know in the historical record there is a burial cloth of Jesus, this purported to be the burial cloth of Jesus, in Constantinople beginning in 944. So what really interests me is sort of the period. Sorry about that train.
That's fantastic.
What really interests me is the period before 1204, the period that even stretching back into the first century, trying to make those links. But here is our biggest challenge with that from history. Our terminology, our vocabulary limits us, because we know this cloth as the Shroud of Turin, which it has been known as officially since 1578. So nobody before then is going to refer to it that way in a document. And we have something called the image of God incarnate. We have something called an image not made by human hands. We have an icon called the Mandylion, which is purported to be the image of Christ on cloth. And so we have all of these different cloths referenced in documents, but gosh, how do we ever make those connections?
Right.
And I think that we are left to fill in the gaps, the mystery that calls us in is in those gaps. And so I like to tell people that after 30 something years of studying the Shroud, I live in the gaps. I don't need it to be authentic to know or to believe in the resurrection, but I sure love being in the mystery of something that no man has yet been able to understand. And another thing I would say to someone who's a skeptic is that that's good, because objects of the material world will always give up their secrets. They always give up their mysteries. We study something long enough and hard enough, and we are going to figure it out. And this is the exact opposite of that. The more we study it, the more curious and more unanswered questions we come up with. And so, I would say to the skeptic, really look at the evidence. Really look at what has been studied, and you will see that the answers remain unknown for the most part, other than, the hard scientific evidence I can give you. And one last thing I do want to say about that is that the carbon 14 dating that came out in 1988, which you probably were going to ask me about this. But the carbon 14 dating, which was done, had a protocol that called for there to be 6 samples taken from across the cloth. And so in 1988, when the results were published, and the scientist involved said that the cloth could be no older than the year 1260. And that's when everyone began to say, oh, it's a medieval fake. Okay. Well, even I remember being in graduate school at the time, I was sort of kicked back by that news. Because carbon 14 dating is the gold standard. It's how we date things organically. We know the science is valid. And so how do we reconcile something that could not have been made in the Middle Ages, because we don't know of any process that would have done it? How could it have been made in the Middle Ages when this person would have had to have understood negative photography 700 years before it was invented? Who would have had to have understood blood spatter technology forensically that we didn't have until the 20th century? ultraviolet light. I mean, there's all these things that left me scratching my head. And then in 2005, of course, I think the whole field opened up again because it was demonstrated the scientists in 1988 violated their own protocol. They didn't take samples from across the whole cloth. They took them only from the top corner where it had been repaired in the early 1500s after a fire.
Hmm.
And by the way, fire creates carbon. And so, you know, it all came into, of course, under serious question again after all that was known. And then recently, of course, the latest peer-reviewed research out there on the carbon-14 dating came out literally about 2 months ago. And it was published in a magazine called Archaeometry. Anybody could go and look it up. And they have basically the entire honest scientific community has completely dismissed the carbon-14 dating of 1988 because, and get this is a real shocker to me, that science is supposed to be objective. Science is supposed to follow a protocol. That's the whole reason we have our faith in science, is that they follow their method. Not only did they violate the protocol, they found two samples that weren't even tested. They were never tested.
Wow.
So yeah, and usually, the reason I really emphasize the carbon-14 dating is because that's usually, if people are skeptical or people are having trouble with this, that's where they come from almost initially, always.
Right.
And would have to overlook all of the other accumulated science, equally scientifically rigorous, to accept one test that even the scientific community doesn't really accept today.
So, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. So, and I mean, one thing that I discovered, now I'm a convert to Catholicism, and I mean, this podcasting and some of my writing and kind of began out of that. And one thing that I was surprised to discover as I read my way into the Catholic Church through the early church and kind of ancient church documents was the amount of, or the reverence or the interest in relics, even in the early church.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Right? So
it's one of our most sacred traditions, yes.
So I think some skepticism comes into the fact that some people might think that relics like the shroud were invented or were quote unquote discovered during the Middle Ages. My understanding, mm-hmm. and you can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that no, relics were something that even the very first Christians saw the importance of. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely correct to say that. And let me tell you how we know that historically. So many of the early fathers speak to this. I mean, I could go on and on, but particularly people like St. John Chrysostom, who speaks about it. St. Jerome is very vocal about it in the early 4th century. So here's what we know. The earliest published complete, like, account of a martyrdom that we have, a first person, like someone actually wrote, sat down and wrote what they witnessed, a martyrdom, was the martyrdom of St. Polycarp of Smyrna that took place about the year 155. And in that account, we have, the first person, the eyewitness account, how people rushed forward to take articles, what was left of his clothing, what was left of his body, because the idea of veneration of a relic, that person was so holy that early Christians, of course, believed that God's grace imbues everything in creation, but especially the human form. We are the highest of all creatures. And so especially there. And so to venerate a remain, and that's all a relic means, is a remain, a relic of a saint, for instance, was to connect with the divine in a very real and tangible incarnational way. And there's nothing weird about incarnational theology. Hello, Jesus is a man, right? there's nothing weird about it. And I think that what happened is that by the time of the Middle Ages, there was such an abuse in the sale and the trade of relics that it cast doubt upon the entire sort of theology of it, which had always been very beautiful. And so then the Protestant Reformation, of course, that was a huge issue for Protestantism, was the abuse of relics. And there's no question, Catholics have to admit that. We have to say that there was a time in our history when we were not only not rigorous about maintaining those, but there was a lot of fabrication that went on. Every church, every monastery, you had to have a relic. I mean, you had to, because that's what brought people to do pilgrimages there. So, but here's my question, and let's link that suspicion that I think is quite valid. It's natural to have a question about anything that has a footprint in the Middle Ages, okay? But let me link this to the shroud. Why on earth, if this were a medieval fake, in an age when anyone could go into a pasture and pick up the cow of a bone of a cow and pass it off as a bone of a saint, and no one would ever know the difference, why such rigorous attention to detail? Why this anatomically, forensically perfect image of a man bearing wounds under ultraviolet light that we can see today align perfectly with a first century Roman flagrum? Why create an elaborate, quote, fake in an age when such, and let's remember, that image wasn't even visible in 1355. You couldn't see it the way we see it today. So I don't know if that touched upon what you wanted me to.
No, absolutely. And then the question is how, right? Not only why make it, but then how make it, right? Because we can't replicate that.
How on earth do you do something with the technology that's not been invented for 700 years?
Right. I think the interesting thing for me with that is, like you say, you couldn't have seen it back then, right? Because my understanding is the real picture we get on the shroud is done through a negative photographic process. Is that right?
Right. That's right. It's actually quite unique among artworks, if you want to call it that. What you're looking at with the naked eye on the shroud is actually the photographic negative. The lights and darks are reversed on the cloth. So you're looking at a negative with the naked eye. When you take a photograph of it, then photographic negative is the positive image. So there, that's one thing that people have a hard time wrapping their heads around. All that is to say that no one knew the positive image until 1898 when that first photograph was taken. And for all these centuries, medieval pilgrims went and fell on their knees and venerated this cloth because someone in authority told them it was the burial cloth of Christ, and that was good enough for them. So we live in a great age of science and skepticism and empiricism, and as soon as that age becomes full bloom in the late 19th century, is it any accident we have the invention of photography that reveals to us the image that we can see? I don't think so.
You've already touched a bit on this, but what are some of the truly amazing features or finds that we've discovered about the shroud?
I think, gosh, there's so many, but something I haven't mentioned, I haven't talked about, is the weave of the cloth itself, which, of course, is very unusual. It's a 3-in-1 herringbone weave, which made it a hand-loomed, it's hand-loomed cloth, which argues for a medieval age because it's a process that wasn't really used by the Middle Ages. This particular weave wasn't really used, but it made it a very expensive cloth. So this is not something that that could have been easily, well, it might have been easily acquired, but it would have had to have been someone with the means to do it, someone with money to acquire it. So the weave of the cloth itself is very unusual. The blood stains on the cloth, now that we know, of course, they're human blood, a type AB. The blood that is on the cloth was present before the image, which when you think about it, what that means is that if this were an artwork, if someone wanted to draw a fake, why would you place the blood forensically, perfectly, according to the blood flow and blood spatter pattern of a crime scene before you'd even created the image? It really kind of boggles the mind. So we know that the blood was there first, and then the image was formed. And then I think also one last thing that to mention to people is that the cloth has three-dimensional code embedded in it. It's very unique in that it is a two-dimensional image, but it has three-dimensional characteristics, which means that it covered an actual human form at the time the image was created. And we've been able to extract that data, today using technologies. We can recreate forensically the position of the body at the time the image was made. The body was in rigor mortis at the time the image was made. There's no sign of physical decay. In other words, the body had not decayed at all when the image was made. So there's just so much. Gosh, I don't know how much you'd want me to talk about, but there's so much there.
No, this is really fantastic. I mean, I have had a strong interest in the Shroud for, as I mentioned, a while, and I'm learning tons of new things. I thought I knew everything about the Shroud, and I'm learning new things. So this is fantastic.
Good.
How does this, you mentioned that there are other artifacts purported to be surrounding Jesus's crucifixion and resurrection. How does this square with the other relics that we have from that time?
Well, probably the most intriguing one is something called the Sudarium of Oviedo, which is a linen cloth that is held, it's a much simpler linen, that's held in Oviedo, Spain. And what this was purported to be is the cloth that covered Jesus' head when his body was taken down from the cross. Now this particular cloth is really fascinating too, because, and let's go back to John's resurrection narrative, John's gospel in chapter 20, where Peter and John have run to the tomb, and John says the burial cloth lying there and the other cloth rolled up in a separate place by itself. Well, what is this other cloth? So many people believe that of course it was Jewish custom, and it's still our custom today, that whenever someone dies a very brutal or horrific bloody death, we cover their face. I mean, we do it in hospital rooms when people die of natural causes. We cover the face. And so this would have been a cloth that probably, as Jesus was being deposed from the cross, someone, Joseph of Arimathea, perhaps Nicodemus, would have wrapped his face. And then the body would have been taken down. Before it was enshrouded, this cloth would have been taken off of the face and rolled up and put in a separate place, exactly as John describes in his gospel, because that had body fluid on it, had blood on it. And under Jewish law, that is part of a human body. It has to be buried with the body. So in the 600s, the 7th century, in Oviedo, Spain, there appears this reliquary that we have great historical record for, a reliquary that was purported to belong to the Apostle James. And in that reliquary was a cloth. And the oral tradition of this cloth was that this was, in fact, that other cloth that's described, John describes in the gospel account. Now, what's so interesting about this is it isn't the same blood type. It is type AB. Same blood type. It is, so we're talking about we're talking about 3.5% of the world's population has that blood type. So what are the odds, first of all, that two cloths that claim to be connected to the burial of Jesus have the same blood type? That is so rare. And I actually would like for someone to compute those odds sometime. If anybody's listening out there wants to compute those odds, I would love to know them. But not only is the blood type the same, but now that we've made such great advances in forensics, anybody that watches CSI knows that you can introduce these things in a court of law. Someone could stand before a jury and say, these two cloths covered the face of the same man. There is, I don't remember, hundreds, over 100 points of agreement forensically in the blood spatter. And one blood stain on the back of the Shroud matches identically with one on the Sudarium. And I'm talking about kind of a complex stain. It's not like a simple one. It's a pretty complex one. And so the reason that that gives more significance, I think, to the carbon 14 dating is think about the logic I've just laid out here. If these two cloths cover the face of the same man, we know where the Scuderia of Oviedo has been since the 7th century. So if those two cloths were in contact with one another, it had to be before the 600s.
Right.
And I think that that alone should be enough to make everyone look at this another time, you know, look at it again.
Wow. That is very fascinating. Do you think, now I listened to you talking about John's gospel account, and
yes,
now those cloths, those artifacts, those relics seem to have been kind of intentionally mentioned there by him. Is that, do you think, a marker or something unusual he's put in there? I mean, we don't know. We can't go talk to him and ask him on a lie detector test.
Right.
You know what I mean? But do you think he's left those there intentionally as a sort of signal to the reader?
I do. And I'm going to tell you, I mean, it's just sort of, this is us interpreting the text. And obviously we shouldn't take anything away from a biblical text that's not there. I mean, at least at first glance without, we're Catholic. We do this in community. So I don't want to put words in John's mouth, but I will tell you this. Think about what John says. He says that they saw the burial cloths lying there, right? And he specifically mentions Peter because Peter is the one who went into the tomb. John didn't. Peter entered the tomb. And he said Peter entered the tomb, saw the burial cloths lying there, and then how does he close out that whole little narrative is by saying that they saw and believed. What did they see? He's not describing the empty tomb. He's describing seeing the burial cloths and believing. He doesn't say, hey, man, we saw the tomb was empty and we believed. He says, we saw the burial cloths lying there and believed. So I think that is intentional. The burial cloths are proof that no one stole the body. I mean, if you're going to steal a body, why are you going to unwrap it? To do it.
Right.
Exactly. And the burial cloths are, of course, the physical remains of that metaphysical event that they believed. And so, I do think the words are very deliberately chosen. And I wish he'd been more specific. I wish he'd said those linens were still smoking hot with the imprint of his body. You know, that would have been great. But no, he simply says we saw and we believed. And so,
yeah, he didn't say, hey, take a picture of it in the 19th century or 20th century,
right,
and then reverse the image. And that would have been more helpful. Right.
Right. Set your iPhone to this setting and you can see it.
Yeah. But we know there's this tradition of these relics dating back to the early church. So what we're to understand then, I think, is this, the event that happened, right? Are we to say, I imagine this was the resurrection, which would have left this imprint on the burial cloth?
Right. So one of the theories, well, let me say this first. There are 17 separate image characteristics. Well, 17 separate characteristics related to the image and the cloth that all have to be met if you're going to put forth some hypothesis about how it was made. For instance, I have people tell me sometimes, oh, you know, you could have done that with camera obscura in the Middle Ages. You know, they were experimenting with that. They were experimenting with, you know, some kind of early photography. I mean, there's all sorts of weirdos, you know, that will argue some ridiculous premise, you know, of how the image could have been made. And the problem is that there are 17 characteristics. Specific characteristics that if you'd have to make a list and you'd say, okay, if I'm going to do this process, I can check off how many of these can I check off that it meets. One of the things that comes closest, of course, are the atomic blasts at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That we know that there are similar kinds of images created in the natural world after that blast, for instance. So, but I said similar. I didn't say exact. These 17 different image characteristics can really only be explained by a process that is a spectrum of light, a spectrum of energy of such intensity in such concentration that we cannot reproduce it in a laboratory today. I've heard, I don't know that this is specifically accurate, but I've heard many physicists throw around 34 trillion watts of energy concentrated in a nanosecond. So that's the only process that explains all 17 image characteristics that have to be met. And so, yeah, let there be light, I guess, you know.
Well, I love that you just called people weirdos. That was my favorite part of that.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, there's always people who come up with, who rather than accept what has already been validly and scientifically demonstrated, would argue some ridiculous, completely made up premise to try to make it work. Yeah. And I meet these people all the time, and I have absolutely no trouble with honest and genuine skepticism that comes from a place of, because to me, skepticism comes from a place of wanting to reach knowledge. That's healthy. What I really struggle with, are people who would rather, create an equally fantastical scenario in the natural world without considering the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That to me comes from a place of ignorance.
Absolutely. So, I love how you talk about living in this beauty of the gaps and the beauty of the mystery, right? And this idea that that this shroud, the more we study it, the deeper we get into this mystery.
Right. The more you are pulled into the mystery. I mean, that's certainly been my experience over the last 30 years, is that the more I know about it, the more I am pulled into that area that between physical and metaphysical, between what is our reality and some unseen, where all of our questions are, all the big questions of our lives are in those gaps. And so it requires something more than empiricism to answer that for me.
Right. So I guess my question then is, and this is, I think, maybe the million-dollar question, is what impact does the existence of the shroud and its seemingly miraculous features have on our faith as Catholics? And I guess another question might be, how should we as Catholics respond to the existence of the shroud?
Yeah. So I don't think, and again, I'll go back to what I said earlier, I don't think that anyone who is a person of faith does not need this shroud to be proven somehow. I mean, I feel like if we found a receipt on the back of it that said, you know, bought at 3 p.m. on a Friday afternoon in 33 A.D. by Joseph of Arimathea, I mean, I don't think that we need that as Catholics. As Christians, we don't need that to believe in the resurrection. But I do think that God makes himself known to us in every way he can. And, you know, I'm always taken back to Thomas, the account of Thomas and in the upper room where he has to touch his side and touch the nail wounds in his hands. And that doesn't mean Thomas is somehow less than the other apostles who saw and believed at the tomb. It means that he came by his knowledge a different way, but he's the first one to proclaim my Lord and my God. So I think that all of this is to say that God reaches out to us across every age in so many different ways, always drawing us close to him. And even if this is just an icon of the passion of Jesus Christ, we can't look at it and not remember what he did for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, we also can't look at it. And I think this has meaning for all Christians, again, and not just Catholics. But, you know, we live in a world where I think we are increasingly somewhat isolated from each other because we're so technological now. And it's very easy for us in our superficial human relationships to look at someone or some situation and say, well, you just don't care. You cannot look at that cloth and see the suffering of this man and say, you don't care. And I think in many ways it's a reminder to us of what was done for us. So I don't think you have to be a Catholic to feel that.
Wow, that's just so fascinating. where can our listeners find out more about your work or about the Shroud, or where do you want to point them for more information?
Okay, so there is a, I would send people to the iTunes store. We have a podcast that is completely free. It's called Who is the Man of the Shroud? There are 36 episodes that were done last year. We begin with the very basic information, all the way through the more complex, some of the more complex scientific information. The iTunes store, however, has got this really weird habit of dropping episodes from time to time. So there is also a WordPress site. If you Googled Who is the Man of the Shroud podcast, you're going to find a WordPress site as well. If you are on Facebook, there is a Who is the Man of the Shroud Facebook page. And I would also send you to the website for the Cathedral of St. John Bertman, which is sjbcathedral.org. sjbcathedral.org. We have all of the podcasts on there as well. So the podcast series is out there. And of course, always there's a great resource in shroud.com, which is Barry Schwartz's website. And it is the largest clearinghouse of information about the Shroud on the web today.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for joining us on
thank
the podcast.
You.
This has been an absolute treat for me. I really appreciate your time, and I think our listeners are going to love learning more about the Shroud of Turin. Thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Cordial Catholic Podcast. I really hope you enjoyed the topic, the episode, and the guest. I think it was fantastic. If you want to know more about Dr. Cheryl White, the Shroud of Turin, the museum, and the work they're doing there, please check out thecordialcatholic.com for the show notes, or find the show notes in whatever podcatcher you use. They're there, all the important links, different ways you can connect with the podcast as well. Follow us on Twitter at thecordialcatholic.com. We're on Facebook at thecordialcatholic. And hey, if you have any feedback to send me, send it to cordialcatholic@gmail.com. I love receiving your feedback. Make sure you visit the website. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast wherever you get fine podcasts. And please make sure to review and like the podcast on whatever platform you're using, if that's a possibility. Your reviews, your subscriptions, your likes help push this podcast out to new people, to new listeners, and I would love for more friends to find this podcast. Hey, if you like the podcast and are interested in supporting the podcast financially, I would love your support. It goes a long way into helping pay for the hosting fees, helping to upgrade the equipment, and to keep the lights on. If you like the content, if you like the guests, if you like the questions and the answers and the conversations, I would love your financial support in addition to any fasting and prayers. You can find us at patreon.com/cordialcatholic, and even as little as $1 a month really helps. I'm hoping to sometime in the near future afford some mobile recording equipment. patreon.com/cordialcatholic helps make that happen. Thank you so much to those already supporting the show. Thanks for listening. Please tell your friends, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.